What do an authentic life lived and a death worth dying look like? How does sitting with the inevitable reality of our deaths impact our willingness to show up in the world as our most true selves so that when we meet our deaths, we are able to die empty? My name is Joelle Simone Maldonado. I'm also known as the Grave Woman. I'm a licensed funeral director, embalmer, death care educator, and the host of this podcast. In this episode of the Death and Grief Talk podcast, I participate in a beautiful exchange with my dear colleague and founder of Going with Grace, Alua Author. Alua is a death doula, recovering attorney, and founder of Going with Grace, a death doula training and end-of-life planning organization that exists to support people as they answer the question, what must I do to be at peace with myself so that I may live presently and die gracefully? Alua is also the author of the book, Briefly, Perfectly Human.
Miss Alua Author, welcome to the Death and Grief Talk podcast.
Thank you, Joelle. I'm so happy to be talking to you today.
I am so excited to be talking to you. I actually had to go through a whole thing earlier and last night. I felt myself getting nervous and I'm like, I don't get nervous before interviewing people. What is this? But I had to redefine that emotion as excitement, which it is. And yeah. I want to ask, what excites Alua Author?
Oh, what excites me? Talking about death still excites me, surprisingly. There was a period of time I thought I was burning out of the work but it was mostly the business stuff and employment stuff and running a business stuff that was burning me out. But I still get really excited talking about death. I get excited about cake still. I get excited about love. I get excited about people living in relationship to their mortality. Yeah. Yeah.
We can't talk about mortality without talking about death. And for those of the listeners that may not be familiar, you're a death doula.
Yes.
Which is what in your definition?
A death doula is somebody who does all of the non-medicalistic care and support of the dying person and the circle of support through the process. But I define the dying person as somebody who has some awareness that death one day will be occurring. So that could be somebody who is healthy and has come into a relationship with their mortality and wants to do some comprehensive end-of-life planning or work through their fears of death. Or it could be somebody who has a disease that they know is going to end their lives and they want to prepare for it. It also looks like working with family members after the death has occurred, helping them wrap up affairs of their loved one's life. So the death doula work spans the life cycle, or at least it should, in my opinion. We think of it often just for those that are very close to the end and sitting bedside and vigiling. But in fact, the work is really layered and complex in its inception and the way that it's most useful.
I love that. You mentioned cake and yes. Immediately put me in the frame of mind of ancestors, because recently I've been baking all these bundt cakes.
Yum. And
was introduced to the knowledge that my great grandmother was an avid baker and a good one at that, a damn good one. And so we can't talk about mortality and death without talking about ancestors. And I'm curious to know, how do you recognize your ancestors and how do you honor them in the work that you do?
Well, just by virtue of being alive, I think is an honoring to them, by virtue of persisting, by virtue of not taking no, by virtue of continuing to do this work that I'm here for, is honoring them. They live in me. And I tell you this quick story. Years ago, I was in the Bahamas and I was in the water. I was skinny dipping late at night. And the water was so warm, felt like a bathtub. And I had this very visceral experience of touching the sand and feeling like it was full of little crushed bones. And I was thinking perhaps it was the bones of folks that had died in the water or had jumped overboard, or ones whose bodies were just thrown in the water after they died, Black folks mostly. And I, in that experience, I also suddenly felt like a hand on my shoulder. And looking back, I could see the hands on all the shoulders going all the way back, which really just clued in that I am but one in a long chain of people that have come before. I am choosing not to have children in this lifetime. So technically it stops with me, but yet it continues on in my nieces and my nephews. But it also continues on in the work that I do in every life that I touch, in that I, as I can't remember who said it, but I am my ancestors' wildest dreams. You know, I do work that feels good to me. I'm able to make a living and support other people in their lives. I am expressed. I am generally joyful. And I think that this is the ancestor still alive and present and working through me. Mm-hmm. What about you? How do you feel?
Honestly, Alua, they talk to me. I see them, like I'm looking at them right now. I'm looking at this land and I can see my grandfather out there working, but I don't just see him. I see the farm in Greenwood and I see the red clay and I think of the blood that was shed in that clay, which is why I think it's red here on the East Coast. I dream about them. I pay honor to them, I think, through using my voice. I've in the past been very afraid to use my voice. I didn't want to offend anyone. I didn't want to ruffle feathers, but I honor them now through using my voice and honestly through red lipstick. Our mouths were covered so that we could not call out and communicate with each other. And so for me, red lipstick is like, no, you're not only going to hear what's coming out of my mouth, you're going to see my lips move. Yes. So
we tell them.
Yeah. That's how I honor them. Some of the ways. And now baking cakes.
Baking cakes. My grandmother was a baker as well. She baked bread though.
Mm.
Yeah. Delicious Ghanaian bread. It's a little sweet. It's kind of like, have you had a bun, a Jamaican or West Indian bun?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like that. It's dense. It's a little sweet. It's hearty. Yeah. Yeah.
You said so many things. You said saying no or not accepting no. What has been the biggest no that you've had to accept?
That's a big question. Oh, I think it may be through my practice of law.
Mm-hmm.
That was a no.
Mm.
And yeah, I had been working for a while to achieve that. I went to college, graduated college, was like, okay, I don't know what to do with myself now. I want to affect justice in some capacity. I am not nearly diplomatic enough. I run my mouth way too much to ever be a politician. I would get myself in so much trouble. I don't have the patience of taking care of other people's children in the school system and like teaching them in that capacity. It's a very, very noble profession. It's not for me, but I think the joke is that now I teach death doulas. But my dad said, well, then why don't you be a lawyer? Because you can do policy work or you can like affect the laws in some capacity. So I went to law school, worked 3 years, took the bar, passed it the first time, one of the hardest things I've ever done, and then started practicing. And 10 years into the practice, realized that it was not for me anymore when I grew really, really depressed and had to find my way back to myself because I'd lost sight of myself in that process. So the no came in, this ain't for you. You know, there were parts of me that knew it, but I did not want to accept it. In fact, I was actively resisting it. But that resistance manifested itself in this really, really serious depression that I grew and then had to work through at some point. It was a big no.
You talk a lot about that bus ride to Cuba and the woman whose conversation changed your life and your brother-in-law who passed away. I was listening to your TED talk over again last night, and you said a phrase that really jumped out to me. And when you said you lost parts of yourself just now, it brought that back up for me. The phrase you use is the I that I think of myself as. Who is that?
Well, that I right now is, I'm talking about the individual sense of self that I operate in the world through, who is Black and female and tall and all the external identifiers, the ones that, you know, you and your experience through magic and science see me as a separate being who looks like these things. The sense of self right now is closely correlated with how I'm expressed in the world, because it's the only way that other people can identify me. However, the other I, the greater I, is one that is connected to all that ever was and all that ever will be, that expresses a sliver of itself as me right now.
What do you think your spirit looks like?
I don't know. I'm really curious about that myself.
I have this theory that, like, you know, we see each other through those external identifiers, right? But I feel like we're also looking at each other's spirits, and how that manifests may be through our skin color or through our hair, whether it's styled a certain way or the colors that we wear, right? Like, I always see you in these bright colors. You posted a video today, I think. I don't know what came up on my timeline today. And you had on black and white. And I was like, huh, that's different. She always wears bright colors, or I always see her in bright colors. So it was striking to me in the sense that you weren't wearing bright colors. It almost looked, I don't want to say off, but different. And I was like, this is what she looks like in black and white. You described that experience on the beach of feeling like you were stepping on little pieces of bone and seeing hands on shoulders and feeling that hand on your shoulder. Do you consider yourself to be a spiritual person?
I do, deeply, deeply. And yet I do my best to talk about the work very secularly, and to not to keep it away from ideas about spirit, because they're present, but I try to remain neutral, at least public and outward facing, so that people can have their own experience and bring that to me, rather than them have any idea about what I actually believe. You know, even though I talk so much about this work and my ideas around how we die, there are so many parts of it that I keep fiercely private. I am actually a very, very private person, which I think surprises a lot of people. Because I'll tell you a lot of things, but there are some things that I hold really sacred, and my spiritual beliefs have to be amongst those, because I got to keep something for myself in this. You know what I mean? Like, I think a big part of doing this work is to give and give and give and give and give, and just crack ourselves open and allow people to take what it is that they need. And so there are parts of me that I have to just lock up and keep for myself and those that are in my immediate circle, and my spiritual sense of self is amongst those things.
Well, that eliminates my next question.
Oh, shoot. What was it?
I was going to ask, what are your spiritual gifts?
Oh, yeah, no.
Okay, I respect that.
Okay.
I respect that. I want to talk, segue, if we can, into Briefly Perfectly Human by Alua Author. Where was he, she, it, they, them born? Where was this book born? Does the book have a personality to you, an identity?
The book is its own thing. The book is its own beast, okay? It's fascinating. Yeah, it's not mine. It's not mine at all. I don't consider myself a writer. I never have. Although somebody did point out to me, I've been keeping journals since I was 17, but those are all just like my private thoughts and my ideas. And in some capacity, this book is still just that, because I went into rooms in some remote location by myself, and click, clack, clacked my heart out. I cried, I laughed, I dug really, really deep to pull out some of these things that need to come out. And what I came to understand at some point is that I would just be clack, 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 clacking, and then come to, and I'd have, you know, a bunch of pages down. The book came through me, but it's not mine. It's not mine. It's not my name on it, because we don't know what human name to put on it, but it exists outside of me. I am its steward in some way. This book was a labor of love. It really labored to be born. It caused a lot of surrender and getting out of the way for it to happen as it needed to. And I'm so grateful that it did, because it taught me a lot about life. It taught me a lot about death. It taught me about myself. And I hope that it teaches and supports other people as well, but it's not mine. They just put my name on it.
If you had to give a thorn and a rose for the process of creating and allowing the book to come through you, what would they be?
The rose is both the end product and the process. The thorn would be the selling of it. And I'm using air quotes because I wish that I could just write the book and leave it out there in the world for all to take with it what they will. However, I'm contracted with the major publisher and got to sell this book in some capacity. And so finding the messaging around it and the languaging around it. And I just kind of want to be like, here, I did it. Take it. Use it. I hope it's helpful in some capacity. Yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of, have you written a book yet?
I've written quite a few. I haven't put any out. Well, I've put two out.
You have? What was that process like for you?
For me, again, my spirits, ancestors, ideas speak to me, right? And so it was literally, for one of them, what are some things that I could say instead of I'm sorry when someone dies? And writing those things down and then organizing them chaotically and saying, oh my God, I can't sit here and reread this 20 times. I have to put it out there. And so I emailed it and it happened in like 2 days, the whole process.
Wow.
Yeah. Now these are by no, they're not thick. They're eBooks, right? Funny that you asked that question. I'm actually working on 18 right now.
18 books?
18 eBooks, small books of short stories and motivation.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Are they going to be compiled into one or they will exist separately?
They will exist separately, but they will be offered as bundles.
All right, get it, girl. Love. I love that idea too. That sounds like quite a process.
It's maddening. It's also like orgasmic at the same time.
Because yeah.
Like, I can get this out. I can do this. It's like a little mini challenge. The way my brain works, Alua, is I have hundreds of ideas nonstop. And if I don't get them out, it would drive me crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can understand. I feel similarly. I think this book took precedence for so long that everything else kind of had to take a back seat because it filled me, but then also expanded me in a way. So there was no space for anything else. I had to leave the running of the business to Elisa Fornaray, who's our COO, and then just trust the team to handle it for a while because I was like, listen, y'all, I'm off on a journey. Me and Book are journeying together and I'll catch you on the other side.
Let me ask you a question. We're talking about that process. What about the times, I don't know if you have them, where creativity is silent? Do you have those moments?
I haven't in a long time in this work. Yeah, there were times writing the book where I couldn't find the inspiration. I couldn't find the words. But one thing that I would do was just sit down at the computer and just start typing. And I would type things like, I don't want to be here right now, or I don't know what to say, or I'm not feeling big enough for this task, or I feel, you know, just being in my experience with whatever it was that was coming up. And then eventually, like I was talking about before, at some point, something else would take over and something useful would come. And then I would just delete all the rest. Those are the times that I felt creativity maybe feeling a little slim. However, in the big picture, I am full of a million ideas for opportunities and experiences for people to be in relationship with their mortality. Like I think about that all damn day. And just in the shower, I had this idea. What if we, like I'm thinking about it constantly. There's not capacity to do it, but I haven't felt it wane in a while, gratefully.
How many or how much of your work, and when I say work, stories from your work, can we expect to see in the book?
There's probably like 10, 11, 12 client stories in there, in addition to my own life story. So the book is a memoir and it tracks my journey into death care, which is also highlighted by some of the client stories that I have. And so it goes into the past, how I got here, and then also in the present of the client work. And each story about my life is highlighted by a client. So I journey into that a bit as well, so that people can perhaps learn a little bit about the work, but also learn about what it is that they can take from people that offer themselves up for this process.
In listening to your TED Talk, I literally laughed out loud when you said you wanted people to clap after, you know, you take that last breath, if that's the way that you're able to go. Can you talk to me a little bit about those last moments and that second minute moments after one of your clients takes their last breath. Death doulas use this phrase, holding space. And I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever heard when I heard you say it and a few other people. But what does it look like to hold space in that moment after life is done?
I think the most important thing to remember is reverence for what we've just witnessed. You know, getting to be in the space when this occurs is such an honor to have been with somebody in the completion of their time here on earth. For me, it's hard to experience anything other than awe. But also let me say that more often than not, even though I am emotionally connected to them because I've likely been working them for a while, it's not instant grief and sadness, it's awe. And it's gratitude for the life that they lived and the fact that they've allowed me into their dying. That awe slows me. That awe forces me to step back and say, oh my God, like what a gift this life is, what a gift this person's life was. It encourages slow moving, patience with the process, honoring the different experiences that are happening around the room, because sometimes there is a tremendous outcry of sadness and grief. But I find that often there's just also awe, like this thing has occurred for somebody. This is a massive moment in their lives, and how can I be present with their experience as well? Stunning. It's really stunning.
Do you become emotional, or have you?
All the time. Yeah, me and my emotional body are good friends, okay? Yeah, we are very well acquainted with each other. One of the early times in my work where I felt like I was really fucked up. Is it okay that I curse?
Totally fine.
Thank motherfucking God. So one of the times that I felt that I'd really fucked up in my work was I was sitting with a client and her sister, and they were actually in the hospital. And I'd come to visit. We had some forms to fill out or something of the sort. And so we filled them out and I sat with them a while longer. And then they started talking about their relationship and it got really densely emotional and there were tears. And then I started crying too. But I was like crying, like just bereft, you know, and try to get myself together, eventually excuse myself to go to the bathroom, but came back and was still very emotional. And then the visit was over. And so I left. And when I got home, I felt really bad about that. I felt like I should not have been crying. Here I am in a position where I'm meant to hold the container in some capacity. And I collapsed into it. And I just felt like shit, like maybe I don't know how to do this or I'm not cut out for it. A couple of days later, sister called me and thanked me for my emotions. She was so grateful because doctors had come in there, nurses had come in there, they would come, they would do the job, they would leave. And she said, for once, somebody else was recognizing how difficult it was for her and was actually meeting her there. And I was like, okay, it helped me see that my sensitivity, this thing that I pushed away for a long time in the practice of law, is actually something that's a benefit in this work. The fact that I can access my emotions and be like, yeah, this really fucking sucks. And it's hard for you. And I can see that. And it's hard for me. And this is hard. You know, I'm grateful that she called to tell me that she was grateful, because I'd probably still be feeling like shit about it right now. Honestly.
I'm just writing down notes because you're saying so many things, and it's just given me so many questions. You mentioned your sensitivity. One of the things that I appreciate about you is that you have such a strong presence. Like just like even now I can feel your presence, being in your presence physically the one time that I was, it just, you resonate so much confidence and strength and just so much. But at the same time, looking in your eyes and looking at you, I see sensitivity. I see fragility. How do you balance that in being a Black woman in the death care industry that is unapologetic about the work that you do?
Just by virtue of being a Black woman out there in the world means that the world is trying to tell me a lot about who I am repeatedly. And all I have to do, I'm making it sound small like that, but if I can stay absolutely grounded in who I actually am, rather than what the world is telling me I need to be, then I'm going to be okay. But that is that's a fight, you know, on some level. It's an absolute fight to say, yes, I'm tall and I have muscles and I have a bigger body in some capacity. And yes, I am strong, but also I'm a delicate flower. Okay. I'm a delicate, delicate flower. Honey, don't do too much because I will cry. I will cry. And to me, that's totally okay. It's okay. I think people expect anger and confidence and don't fuck with me. I'm a badass. I got this all the time. I don't got it a lot of the time. I need people. I need support. I feel broken by things. My feelings get hurt. And to me, that's fine because I'm human and it's who I am. And I'm okay with that, you know? But in the industry in particular, I think it can be tricky sometimes because I think that often I'm perceived or supposed to be one way or, and I'm not, I am who I am. And I make choices. Sometimes they're not great ones. I do some things that sometimes are fucked up and I'm learning and I'm in process. And I hope that everybody continues to give me the grace to actually be a whole human and not just their idea of who they think I should be. But it's tricky. I'm sure you know this quite well yourself.
It's like what you're saying, I feel it. Like I feel it inside because it's true, especially being like a plus size woman and traveling places like California or the West Coast where I didn't see a lot of women. I'm pretty sure they're out there, but I didn't see them that look like me or being, I remember when I was growing up, God bless my grandfather. I loved him. He did so many wonderful things. Wonderful. But one of the worst things that I think he passed, not even passed on, but has said to me when I was younger was, you don't want to ever be fat because people won't take you seriously. I grew up to be fat or plus size or whatever word you want to use, right? And for a while, that rang in my ears.
For sure.
Not necessarily truth, but like it was always something. Well, I'm going in this boardroom, but they're not going to take me seriously. I'm presenting myself, but I'm not going to be taken seriously. And it hurt, but more than anything, it made me angry when I really sat with it. And I've had to do a lot of work to overcome that, but it so resonates with me what you said about showing up as who I am, not necessarily what someone sees. You mentioned your biggest no being your journey with law, right? But mm-hmm. I'd imagine as a death doula and the legalities around death, that experience has been beneficial in some way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think similarly into the way that my sensitivity is an asset in this work, I'm grateful for every part of who I've been and every part of my journey to get me here because it's useful. Granted, I'm not so keen on the $113,000 I still have in student loan debt to this day, but I am still really, really grateful for it. Law school taught me a lot of things. It taught me how to take in a bunch of information and whittle it down to the most crucial component very quickly. It taught me how to issue spot. I can look at a situation and see where the holes are and see what it is that we have to fix. It allowed me to learn how to critically think, but also to speak very directly and not to waste a lot of words on things. Don't get me wrong. I still have a lot of words to use, but the legal schooling and the practice of law taught me a lot that is very useful, my death practice. However, the most useful thing that it taught me was around my boundaries. Mm-hmm. I worked in legal aid before, and so I worked with low-income folks in domestic violence cases and sexual assault cases. And I also worked with government benefits folks who had their benefits taken from them and need to reinstate them. And before I was formally practicing law, when I was a law student, I worked at the South Brooklyn HIV and AIDS unit, the legal services. And there was a client that I was doing everything for. She was about the same age as me. She was a Black woman. She had a teeny weeny gap in her teeth, not like mine, but it was like small. She had a small fro like I did at the time. And she felt like my homegirl. And I was willing to do whatever it was that she needed. I wrote about this experience in the book. And my supervisor at the time was like, slow down. And I was like, but why? She was like, well, you're doing more than you are contracted to do for this case. And I said, but if it were me, I would want somebody doing all these things for me as well. And she said, it's not you. It was revolutionary. It still is to this day. That is not me. It's not my experience. I was contracted to do this much of the thing that she'd asked for, and I had to focus on just that. I was willing to give her my skin, but she only needed, she'd come to me for this much. And so the practice of law continually redefined my boundaries, like getting clear on what belongs to me and what belongs to somebody else. And that's, I think, the most important thing that I've carried into this work.
So a lot of times when people hear terms like, or occupations like lawyer, funeral director, death doula, they associate certain perceptions about money. And it's almost, in our industry, money is a bad word. And I tell people all the time, working in death care is not a vow of poverty. Like, it's not. How do you balance offering services for money and caring for people that are in a vulnerable state?
I think the challenge is around capitalism. Mm-hmm. And where we place negative value or stereotypes or meaning around it. To me, money is a monetary, it's an energetic exchange. It's just presented in a way that realistically is totally illusory. I mean, obviously it matters a lot when you don't have any, but also there's figures in my bank account right now that mean nothing to me because they're just figures right now until they're able to, I can exchange it for something to get something that I find valuable, you know? When it comes down to this profession that I've chosen, there is an inherent value in it. I think it's priceless what it is that we offer. And yet I am using my brain, my time, my emotional body, all of my skills that I worked really hard to cultivate in support of you. And when I do that, there's a contribution that comes back. And mm-hmm. what we've decided, the agreement that me and the client have often made, is money. That is the thing that comes back to me for all these things that I'm giving for you. Just an energetic exchange. We pay for a lot of healing professions. You know, we pay for therapists. We pay for massage therapists. We pay for reflexology. I pay to get my nails done. They give me a lot of joy and beauty. If I can offer something, thank you. If I can offer something to somebody that brings them some peace, some joy, some something in their life, and they give money back, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. I think we have to think outside of the notions of capitalism as it currently is set up, say that the exchange is how it's being defined right now. I would be more than happy to take bread. There were many times in my career, many times where I did not have very much money, and yet my community really held me. And they would take me to dinner and they would buy me wine and my homegirls would buy me trips when we were going places. And that was a different type of exchange. And that's okay too. Now it just looks like money.
How important have your friendships been, not only in your career, but in writing this book?
I would not have been able to do it without them, any of it. I am blessed. I have some really, really great friends. My best friend was my freshman year college roommate. We were thrown together and now 30 some odd years to get later, here we still are. I rely on her for so much. She is actually at the top of my messages that I'm looking at right now behind the screen. She is warm and funny and doesn't take any disrespect from anybody and will be quick to let me know when I am. And she reminds me of who I am. She also reminds me of what I'm not. And I am so, so, so grateful. My homegirls from law school saw me through that. We are all very different. One of these things is not like the other. They're all, you know, mid-40s white women living in Colorado, working corporate law jobs. One of them is a judge. And then there's me, like black death doula, lives in California, whatever. But we made a solid friendship when we were in law school. These folks, and then the friends that I've made over the years as well, these folks are the ones that have kept me on the path when I get confused or lost. They're the ones that, like I was saying, would buy my plane ticket when we wanted to take a trip and I couldn't afford it. They're the ones that are buying my book currently for their friends and family elsewhere. They're buying it in like 20 and 30s, you know. Gosh, I feel so much gratitude just even thinking about the experience of my friendships over the years. But I feel like it's necessary in this work to have community. Gratefully, I have community outside of death care, and I have community within death care too. Yeah. And you are part of that community within death care. Thank you.
I appreciate you, Alua. Thank you. And you're welcome.
Yes. And you're welcome.
Where do you place value?
I think I place value in my expression. In expression overall. In my capacity to feel into all parts of who I am, to feel into like my history, to be able to have grief and joy at the same time, to celebrate and want to hide in a cave at the same time. Place a lot of value in being fully expressed as a human. That also looks like how I carry myself physically, like what I wear, the words I speak, the places that I choose to speak those words, and who I choose to share them with. I place a lot of value in beauty. I don't mean vanity. I don't mean my face or, you know, but I mean like the blades of grass also, and like the formations of the clouds. I place a lot of value in the sunset. I place value in connection with a fellow human. Like, it's so rad that I get to look my boo in his eyeballs and connect to something behind there. And he looks me in my eyeballs and I melt. Like, I place a lot of value in connection and in relationship.
One thing that when preparing for this and just learning about you online that I appreciated was seeing you online with your niece.
Yeah.
Like the joy that exudes from you in the videos and in your voice. And when you write things about her online, it makes me happy. It makes me look forward to motherhood. It makes me look forward to becoming an auntie. And so thank you for sharing that. You mentioned how private you are, but you share that. And I think that's really cool.
That's my baby girl. We share a birthday.
Oh, you right.
Yeah. Yeah, she was born 9 weeks early. Mm. And of all of the days to choose, she chose mine. That is my girl. We were talking about our no's before. Another big no of mine has been motherhood. It's a no for me, dog. It's a no for me. And yet I'm so grateful that I get to have these experiences with these young ones. I have a nephew also. He's 19 and he's grown, if you ask him. But so I feel so grateful to have these relationships with these young ones. I have godchildren over the course of their lives that still allows me some access into that area, but they go home and nobody's bothering me on Saturday morning at 6 a.m. to make them some cereal. Okay. Nobody. Thank God. It's not for me.
I just realized why I appreciate seeing that so much. It reminds me of my uncle when I see you guys.
Oh.
Like, it's not my mom, it's not my dad, but it's like that person you can tell anything and they're not going to beat your ass. They're not going to, you know, judge you or tell you to do this or that. They're just going to say, okay, let's go skate. You know?
Yeah. Be like, wow, that sounds really hard. What can I do? Nothing. Okay, baby, you just need to tell me. I'm glad you did. You want some cake?
Yeah. Two more questions. I don't know where I was trying to think last night where I saw you do this or say this, but you talked about closing chakras when someone is in transition and at those final moments. First and foremost, where do you learn to close chakras? Because everything we hear about chakras is open and they need to be flowing. But when I heard you talk about that, it was like, oh my God, that makes sense. These portals need to be closed in order for us to fully exit. And is that something you do with the family? How does that come about? Like, how does that conversation even present itself?
Okay. So for starters, I want to say that I heard about the practice before in my doula training, and then I met some folks, some Indian folks that actually knew the practice in their tradition, and they taught me. And for within the context of doula training, with any of these techniques that we offer or that we say, hey, this is a potential, we always say, go find the people that have this practice as part of their tradition and learn from them. So I learned directly from those folks. And what I learned was the importance of kind of cleansing the system of the sludge. The chakras build up a lot of sludge while we live. And you cleanse and close them at the same time to allow the energetic body to separate from the physical body. I'm ever only doing this practice with somebody who also believes in that system. And so we have plenty of buy-in beforehand before we're doing it at all. And I lost track of your question.
I was just curious about where you learned to do that,
Yes.
what the purpose was, and you answered that.
Yes.
And you also answered, how does that conversation come about? So you answered the question.
Yes. Okay, great. We got it.
All
Yeah.
right. One last question, Alua. Well, not really the last question, but the last question. Do you have any regrets? And if so, what are they?
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Yeah, for a while I carried regret. I think until I started being comfortable with the ride that I'd had thus far. For a while I regretted going to law school. I felt like I'd wasted my time. Now I see, as we were talking about earlier, that it is a really important and necessary part of my work. And also having that law degree, having the little Esquire behind my name does buy me entry into rooms and bestow some level of illusory respect based on our capitalistic white supremacist system, that aside. But for a while, I regretted it. There's been steps that I've made that I've been like, I don't know if that was the right one. And yet, part of the reason why I call the book briefly Perfectly Human is because my ride has been perfect exactly as it is. And all of our rides are, you know, for what they are. I can't say I do anymore. Do you?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And one of them, I'll tell you one of them. The last conversation I had with my Uncle Mark, the one that your relationship or what I see of your relationship with your niece reminds me of. One of the last conversations we had, I was complaining like about this horrible boss I had, and I didn't know he was gonna die. We knew he was not well. But I didn't know I wasn't going to be able to talk to him again and him talk back. And I hate the fact that I spent that time talking about that bullshit. Someone I don't even think about unless I think about that moment anymore.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think it serves as a really powerful reminder about how we use our time, with the people that we love. Yeah, it's powerful.
So please tell us where we can order the book, how we can find more about. Oh, I do have one more question.
Yes.
Sorry. What is the symbol for going with grace? What does that
Oh,
represent?
great. It's an Asasiedru, which is it's an Adinkra symbol. I'm from Ghana, and we have a language of proverbs that are written in symbols, and it's one of those symbols. There's a couple that have gotten really popular. One is the Jinyame. I don't have one nearby, so I can show you. But this is one of those symbols. Now, the story behind it is that years ago, my homegirl was having a birthday and she wanted a tattoo. So I bought her a tattoo for her birthday. So a bunch of homegirls go out for brunch beforehand, bottomless mimosas, and then we all roll to the tattoo shop. And she was just getting a tattoo, but one by one, all the homegirls are like, I want one too. I want one too. Bottomless mimosas. And so I was like, well, shoot, I can't be the only one not to get one. And in my head somewhere, I thought that I'd wanted a tattoo at some point of one of these Adinkra symbols. I had other ones. And so I'm like on the internet, just looking, looking, looking to find one. And I see this one and I think it's very pretty. I read a little bit about it and I said, this is great. Slap it on my foot. So I got this big tattoo on my foot. I think it's crooked. Okay. But whatever. I got it. Did I mention bottomless mimosas?
Yes,
Okay.
you did.
Okay. And I left with the biggest tattoo out of all of them. All right. So that was maybe like 17 years ago or so. Years later, when I built Going With Grace and I was looking for a logo, I'd rented some, like asked some folks to draw things and nothing was quite right. And I didn't know what to do. And I'm sitting at the laptop with my feet up and I see the tattoo on my foot. And I thought, huh, well, that's beautiful. And also Asasiyadru means that the earth has weight. That's a literal translation. But it's meant to remind us that the troubles of this world are illusory. It feels weighty, but it isn't necessarily. And so I thought, well, that's really useful for a thing about death. I did more research and found out that one of the other meanings of it is timely preparations for future eventualities, the weight. And I thought, well, that's, I mean, that sounds like it's it to me. So I started using it for the business and I'm so glad I did. It's beautiful. It looks like, you know, two hearts reflected back. So it looks kind of like as on earth, so above. I also see it often in wrought iron fencing here in Los Angeles. And I hear also in parts of Louisiana, because it's what the iron workers who were Black, one of the symbols that they used, which I think is just wonderful and fascinating. And yeah, that's it.
I love that. And the name, Going With Grace.
Going With Grace came to me in a Vipassana meditation. It's a 10-day silent meditation retreat. I didn't know what to call the business and I've been struggling and everything I wanted was taken, like the journey home. Everything was taken and I was just crushed. So I went to this meditation retreat that had been scheduled long before I was really looking for a name. And you can't write anything in this meditation retreat. You don't talk to anybody. You don't read anything. It's just you and your meditation. Day three, it floated in my brain and I thought that's really, really beautiful. And I hope I remember, I hope I remember, I hope I remember. And then I did. And then I searched and it was available. And I love the connotation of going through life and also into our death with grace. And to me, that means for exactly what it is.
Thank you so much, Olua, for your time. And now, would you let us know where we can find the book, where we can learn more about Going With Grace and about your offerings for those that want to get into death doulaship?
Great. We train death doulas at Going With Grace. We train about 2,500 in 17 countries so far, which is so exciting to me. It's where I find a lot of joy and hope about how this world is living in relationship to death. You can find us on the internet, goingwithgrace.com. You can find my book. Hopefully find it in an independent bookstore, please. Find it in an independent bookstore, please. 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 Okay, that's all.
Thank you so much, Olua, for your time.
Thank you, Joelle.
For your words and wisdom.
My pleasure.
All of Olua's information will be in the description box below or in the notes for this podcast episode. Live life, love hard. We'll talk to you next time.